Thank you, Peter. Good morning. We are here at the WFMT Levin Performance Studio with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. We just had a fascinating conversation about her love of music, and we're going to continue that theme, but in a different way in this next hour. For the next hour, Justice Ginsburg will present a talk that she has given on several occasions, and it's about the two passions of her life, opera and the law, in that order. And it will be a program of selected scenes that deal with law and justice as depicted in opera, performed by members of the Patrick G. and Shirley W. Ryan Center at Lyric Opera. And they are Annie Rosen, mezzo-soprano, Alec Carlson, tenor, Jesse Donner, tenor, and Patrick Getty, bass, along with Craig Terry, who's the music director at the Ryan Center. He will be our pianist today. I wanted to, before you give the talk, I just wanted to ask you about the inspiration for this discussion that you've done on several occasions. At first glance, the two subjects may seem quite different, but many opera plots are centered around injustice and disputes. So that seems a natural subject for what you're talking about today.
I was first stimulated to give such a talk by Francesca Zambello for the Glimmerglass Music Festival. The first year, it was a straight spiel. And then I thought it would be ever so much more inviting if we had the young singers illustrating the points I made in the talk. So that's has been the formula. We've done it at the Castleton Festival, the venue for the grand world opening of the opera buffo, Scalia Ginsburg. And we did it at Glimmerglass again this year.
So the scenes that you have selected are much more than court scenes or judicial decisions. They really do explore every aspect of law. So how did you come upon the, how did you select the scenes that we are going to hear today?
To some extent, it depended on the singers who were available. Some of the selections didn't work out, and so it was a cooperation between the singers and me about what would best illustrate the points I was making. But you will see in what you are about to hear that there's some themes familiar. Any talk about opera and the law has to include an operetta by Gilbert and Sullivan, because Gilbert was the greatest satirist about law and lawyers. And then we are going to open with the most famous plea bargain in all of opera, and I'll tell you more about that in a moment. Then prisons, they abound in grand opera. Trial scenes, there are many things to choose among.
Well, shall we get started?
Fine.
Here now is Opera and Law with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and members of the Ryan Opera Center at Lyric Opera.
I'm so glad to be aided today in this talk about opera and the law by the young singers from the Chicago Lyric Opera's Ryan Center. But truth be told, lawyers do not figure nobly in opera plots. Most often they show up as notaries, authenticating documents, mainly marriage contracts, and have not too many notes to sing. There are bit parts for a lawyer in Fledermaus and in Porgy and Bess. The lawyer in Fledermaus, Dr. Blind, is so ineffective, he gains for his client, Eisenstein, a few extra days in jail. And the lawyer in Porgy and Bess offers Bess a divorce for a dollar, then ups the price to $1.50 when Bess tells him she was never really married before. Law enforcement does figure importantly in many an opera plot. Prisons are favorite settings for doleful arias and duets that sometimes run on rather long. Regular opera goers will think immediately of Fidelio, Trovatore, Don Carlos, Faust, Tosca, Dialogues of the Carmelites, and more recently, Dead Man Walking, plus scores more. The law enforcement illustration chosen for WFMT listeners is in a lighter vein. It involves a jail order, not a prison sentence, and it portrays a plea bargain of a most unusual sort. In Act One of Bizet's Carmen, Carmen has assaulted and wounded a co-worker in a Seville cigarette factory. To punish her for that infraction, the captain of the brigade orders Don Jose, the hapless tenor, to cart Carmen off to jail. En route, she negotiates a deal. If Don Jose allows her to escape, she will sing and dance for him at the cabaret owned by her friend Lilith Pastor. Ryan Opera Center artist Annie Rosen, mezzo-soprano, will be Carmen, and Jesse Donner, tenor, will portray Don Jose, and they will demonstrate how Carmen gained her liberty in the seductive Seguidilla scene. And at the piano, for all the Ryan Opera Center young artists, music director Craig Terry. Annie and Jesse.
Où me conduirez-vous?
À la prison, et je n'y puis rien faire.
Vraiment, tu n'y peux rien faire?
Non, rien. J'obéis à mes chefs.
Eh bien, moi, je sais bien qu'en dépit de tes chefs eux-mêmes, tu feras tout ce que je veux. Et cela, parce que tu m'aimes.
Moi, t'aimer?
Oui, José. La fleur dont je t'ai fait présent, tu sais, la fleur de la sorcière, tu peux la jeter maintenant. Le charme, mon père.
Ne me parle plus. Tu m'entends? Ne parle plus. Je le défends.
Je n'ai guère le temps d'attendre, car avec moi Tanzania. Oui, j'irai chez mon ami Leros Bastia. Tais-toi, je t'avais dit de ne pas me parler. Je ne te parle pas, je chante pour moi-même. Je chante pour moi-même. Je pense à certains officiers, je pense à certains officiers qui m'aiment et comme autour, oui, comme autour, je pourrais bien aimer.
Carmen,
mon officier n'est pas un capitaine.
Carmen, je suis comme un ivre. Si je cède, si je me livre, ta promesse, tu la tiendras. Ah, si je t'aime, Carmen, Carmen, tu m'aimeras.
Oui.
That was a great start. As the opera progresses, Carmen gets a man, and then she does him woefully wrong. Contracts are prominent in opera plots. The Sturm und Drang in Wagner's Ring Cycle stem from a breach of contract, Wotan's attempt to renege on his agreement to compensate the giants, Fafner and Fasolt, for building Valhalla, heavenly home of the gods. The centrality of contract in the ring was brought home to me vividly some years ago when a law clerk applicant, submitted as his writing sample an essay titled The Significance of Contract as Played Out in Wagner's Ring Cycle. What better illustration of the well-known legal maxim, pacta sunt servanda, in plain English, agreements must be kept. I hired that law clerk applicant on the spot. We will now hear a recording of Abendlied from Das Rheingold. In this great aria, Wotan joyfully leads his wife Fricka and the other gods as they enter Valhalla.
Thank you.
That was George Schulte conducting, and George London, an unforgettable voice. George London was my first Dutchman, and there's never been another for me since then. Well, let's move on now to trials and inquests. They abound in grand opera. I'll mention just a few. The poet Andrea Chenier, who is condemned by the Revolutionary Tribunal. In Aida, the priests condemn Radames for treason. In Norman, the pagan throng lets their high priestess burn for breaking her vow of chastity. A shipboard court-martial takes place in Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd. A little background for the scene. Billy is as good as he is beautiful. He is relentlessly pursued by First Officer John Claggart, who epitomizes evil. Claggart falsely accuses Billy as the ringleader of a mutiny. I should tell you that Billy Budd was based on Herman Melville's novella, the character of Captain Vere was Melville's father-in-law, Lemuel Shaw. Shaw was an abolitionist, but he was also a judge of Massachusetts, obliged by his oath to enforce perhaps the most regrettable clause in our Constitution, the Fugitive Slave Clause. A conflict of the same order confronts Captain Vere and Billy Budd. Captain Vere knows that Billy is good and Claggart evil, and yet the law requires that a sailor found guilty of assaulting a superior officer hang from the yardarm. How should he resolve the conflict? How should Captain Vere decide between man's law and divine justice? Listen in, and you will hear Captain Vere's aria, "I accept their verdict." And it is sung by Mr. Getty. By Mr. Donner. Yes, thank you. Okay.
I accept their verdict. I accept their verdict. Death is the penalty for those who break the laws of earth. And I, who am king of this fragment of earth, of this floating monarchy, have exacted death. But I have seen the divine judgment. judgment of them. I've seen iniquity overthrown, cooped in this narrow cabin, I have beheld the mystery of goodness. And I am afraid before what tribunal do I stand if I destroy goodness? Handsomeness, goodness, it is for me to destroy you. I, Edward Fairfax Vere, captain of the Indomitable, lost with all hands on the infinite sea. I am the messenger of death, the messenger of death. How can he pardon? How receive me?
Thank you, Jess. That was a great rendition. So what would you do if you were Captain Vere? The Drumhead Court has convicted Billy, and they've sentenced him to death. Should Vere have accepted the court martial's verdict as he did, or should he have assured Billy Budd's liberty? And it is the conflict that Judge Shaw faced. He had a decision to make. If he's to remain a judge, he must apply the law of the land, which required runaway slaves to be returned to their masters. And if he did what divine justice required, he would resign from his office. That was his choice. We will next hear a selection from Jake Heggie's Dead Man Walking. It's an opera, as you know, about a man on death row. Unlike Billy Budd, Joseph DeRoche, the condemned man, has indeed done a terrible thing. But his mother asks in a moving aria, what does killing him accomplish? Some context before Ryan Center artist Annie Rosen returns to portray Mrs. DeRoche. On June 29th, the last opinion announcement day of the Supreme Court's 2014 to 2015 term, the court upheld lethal injection, as currently compounded, as a permissible means of carrying out executions. The vote was 5-4. I joined Justice Breyer's separate dissent, which addressed a more basic question, whether the death penalty, whatever the means employed, is itself unconstitutional. What had experience showed since 1976, when after a four-year hiatus, the court allowed states to reinstate the death penalty? Justice Breyer listed four considerations worthy of the court's consideration. First, reliability or accuracy. Post 1976, more than 100 individuals convicted of capital crimes and sentenced to death were later fully exonerated. The state had fastened on the wrong man. Some of the exonerations came years after the executions took place. Second, arbitrariness. Factors that should not affect imposition of the death penalty, studies have documented, often do. Prime among those factors, race and geography. Third, a matter of time. The average execution in the United States occurs some 18 years after the individual was sentenced to death. Much of the reason for the long delays is the multiple opportunities for appeals available to prisoners sentenced to death. So delay might be regarded as a self-inflicted wound. Yet conditions during the wait can be cruel, especially if waiting time is spent in solitary confinement. But what is the alternative to delay? Last year, a man on death row was exonerated by DNA evidence after spending 30 years on death row. If his sentence had been carried out swiftly, or in 10 or even 20 years, he would not have lived to know of his exoneration. Fourth, and perhaps in light of the first three considerations, the incidence of the death penalty has steeply declined. 19 states have abolished it, including most recently Nebraska, by ballot initiative, by popular vote. In 2014, only 7 of our states conducted executions. In 43 states, there were none. And beyond that, the practice is largely confined to a small and diminishing subset of counties. Ultimately, the considerations Justice Breyer discussed at length may bring us back to the years 1972 to 1976. When no executions took place in the United States. Let's listen now as Mrs. DeBroche, the condemned man's mother, pleads for her son's life. Annie?
Is this what I talk into? I feel like I'm on TV or something. Do you all ask me questions or do I just talk? Sister Helen helped me write something. I don't read so good. My eyes. I'm sorry. I
asking you to spare her son's life. Nothing more, nothing less. My son Joseph's life hasn't been an easy one. His father left us when he was 2. He didn't get along with his stepfather. We were poor, always poor. Joe was a poor student.
I can't pronounce this word. Dyslexia.
He left school in the 9th grade, went with a bad crowd. There was drugs and some crime involved. I believe there was a woman and a child. None of this excuses the terrible thing my Joe has been convicted of. I'm not saying that. I'm saying
thank you.
We will now have a change of pace for our final selection. I will turn to the ongoing debate over literal versus purposive reading of the law. In the Supreme Court term just ended, that dichotomy was evident in some dueling opinions, as it is in diverse operatic scenes. The illustration we are about to hear comes from Gilbert and Sullivan. Though they wrote operettas, not grand operas, no team rivals Gilbert and Sullivan in treating law and lawyers satirically. On the distinction between strict and sensible construction of legal texts, Pirates of Penzance provides the most apt example. The operetta's hero, Frederick, when he was a little lad, was on his father's instruction to be apprenticed to a pilot. Frederick's nursemaid, Ruth, was a little hard of hearing, so she apprenticed Frederick to a pirate instead of to a pilot. The terms of the apprenticeship: Frederick would serve the pirates until his 21st birthday. When Frederick has lived 21 years, he is released from the pirate band, and he promptly undertakes to annihilate all of his former colleagues in league with his father-in-law-to-be, a character who is the very model of a modern major general. But the pirate king and hard-of-hearing nursemaid Ruth, now serving as the piratical maid of all works, pay a visit to Frederick. They know how fond he is of jokes, and so they have come to tell him of a most amusing paradox. Frederick was born in leap year on the 29th of February. Strict construction of his bond would make Frederick a lad of five and a little bit over. Purposive interpretation would count his years on earth and acquit him of his obligation to the pirates. The Ryans and his trio presenting this paradox are Alex Carlson as Frederick, Annie Rosen as his nursemaid Ruth, and Patrick Getty as the Pirate King.
To raise our spirits faint, according to our custom old, with quips and quibbles quaint. But all in vain the quips we heard, we lay and sobbed upon the rocks, until to somebody occurred a startling paradox.
A paradox.
A paradox, a most ingenious paradox, with quips and quibbles heard in flux, but none to beat this paradox.
A paradox, a most ingenious paradox. This paradox. Your taste, your curious quips, for cranks and contradictions queer, and with that laughter on our lips, we wished you there to hear. We said if we could tell it him, how Frederick would the joke enjoy, and so we've risked both life and limb to tell it to our boy.
That paradox,
that most ingenious paradox, we've quips and quibbles heard in flux, but none do beat this paradox.
A paradox, a paradox, a most ingenious paradox.
Ridiculous reason to which, however, I've no desire to be disloyal. Some person in authority, I don't know who, very likely the astronomer royal, has decided that although for such a beastly month as February, 28 days as a rule are plenty, 1 year in every four, his days shall be reckoned as 29. Through some singular coincidence, I shouldn't be surprised if it were owing to the agency of an ill-natured fairy. You are the victim of this clumsy arrangement, having been born in leap year on the 29th of February. And so, by a simple arithmetical process, you'll easily discover that though you've lived 21 years, yet, if we go by birthdays, you're only five and a little bit over.
Dear me, let's see. Yes, yes, with yours my figures too agree. Quaint the ways of paradox, at common sense she gaily mocks, though counting in the usual way is 21 I've been alive, yet reckoning by my natal day, yet reckoning by my natal day, I am a little boy of five,
it's a little boy of five.
A paradox, a most ingenious paradox. A paradox, a curious paradox.
There is a happy ending. It turns out that the pirates were lapsed members of the peerage. They returned to their former stations as members of the House of Lords. for above all else, pirates, policemen, and everyone else on stage unite in fidelity to their queen. There is a similar reconciliation in the new opera, Scalia Ginsburg. Composer librettist Wang wrote a duet for Justice Scalia and me. It is titled, We Are Different, We Are One. Different on questions of major import, but one in our reverence for the institution we serve. Never mind the words of some spicy opinions. We genuinely respect and even like each other. Collegiality of that sort is what makes it possible for the court to do the ever-challenging work the Constitution and Congress assigned to us without the animosity that currently mars the operations of the political branches of our government. I think our hour has ended. So everyone in the studio audience, I invite to join with me in rousing applause for the Ryan Center artists who performed for us today and for everyone who had a hand in arranging this program.
You have just heard Opera and the Law as presented by Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, along with artists from the Patrick G. and Shirley W. Ryan Opera Center, and they were Annie Rosen, mezzo-soprano, Alec Carlson, tenor, Jesse Donner, tenor, and Patrick Getty, bass, along with Craig Terry, who is the music director of the Ryan Center. He was our pianist today. Our many thanks also to Dan Novak, who's the director of the Ryan Opera Center, to Jim Ginsburg, president of Say D Records, Sidney Gillard, Patrice Michaels, the Glimmerglass Festival, David Polk, Louise Frank, the producers of our program today, and our engineer was Mary Mazurek. And of course, thank you, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Thank you, and we will go back now to the studio with Peter Van de Graaff.